use it or lose it. We have already learned that dendrites, axons, and glial cells multiply in response to mental challenges. It is, in fact, to the rigorous intellectual regimen of the Moncado nuns that Snowden attributes their robust neurophysiology. Even more than others, their religious order condemns the sin of mental idleness. They forbid their brains the luxury of downtime. Many of the sisters pursue higher degrees. They play quiz games and solve brain teasers to pass the time, and they debate politics in weekly seminars. Most important, each nun keeps a detailed journal of her personal spiritual quest, like Audrey Hepburn in The Nun Story. They examine their souls daily and record on paper what lies within. Which brings us to this hands-on principle, illustrated that when Marion Diamond carried out her famous experiment of putting rats in a super-stimulating environment, she also tested a control group. This control group was not allowed to play with the toys, swings, ladders, treadmills, trapezes, and other delights enjoyed by the super rats. They were, however, allowed to watch the super rats play. They got to watch over the shoulders of the other rats that just couldn't play with the toys directly. Certain theories of child development hold that stimulating input alone will enhance a child's intellectual growth. By analogy, Diamond spectator rats should have sprouted extra neurological connections just by watching the other rats play, but somehow they didn't. The spectator rats died just as young and had interconnections just as sparse as did their less fortunate counterparts in barren cages who were not allowed to watch. Clearly, input alone did not create super rats. The rats had to play and touch the toys directly in order to gain brain power. This suggests that the super rat effect was a feedback loop. The more the rats physically interacted with their environment, the more stimulation that environment fed back to them in the form of brain growth. It's an issue in expression in the circuit. What you put out, you get back. Diamond's finding dramatically underscores something neurologists have known for 80 years. A sizable portion of our brain's physical development depends not on genetic inheritance or even on outside stimulus, but rather on the feedback from our own spontaneous and expressive activity. I call this the expression circuit. It's also core of a model I call feeding the loop. Santiago Ramón y Cajal noted in 1911 that the microneurons of the cerebellum, in the back of the brain, develop in direct response to an infant's activities. More recently, neurophysiologist José M. R. Delgado has observed that up to 90% of the neurons in certain parts of the brain take form after birth, their numbers and structure heavily influenced by sensory inputs from the environment. Although this powerful feedback loop has been recognized for over 80 years, its implications for accelerated learning and personal growth have long been overlooked. By harnessing the power of self-expression and of sensory feedback, we can actually change the physical form of our brains. Even such basic activities as creeping and crawling, the feedback from those activities can physically change the brain. For example, a psychologist once studied two American Indian tribes who lived so closely together that their reservations were physically intertwined. The tribes shared similar cultures and economic circumstances. Yet one tribe tested with an average IQ over 25 points higher than that of the other. This tribe, the researcher noticed, allowed its infants to creep and crawl freely, while the tribe with lower average IQ restrained them. Watch a baby's eyes as it creeps about the floor on its hands and knees. As each hand moves forward in turn, the baby's eyes focus on that hand, back and forth, following each hand many thousands of times. The baby is not only learning to crawl, it's also training its eyes to work together at arm's length. Each time the baby expresses its will by reaching out a hand, it receives feedback through the touch of the rug. the sight of the hand executing the brain's orders, and the sense of achievement that no doubt comes from successful locomotion across the floor. The feedback principle is more powerful than that, even, if we look at how Stephen Hawking has cheated death for at least 35 years. The feedback principle has a lot to do with why renowned physicist Stephen Hawking is still alive and working. After diagnosing Hawking with Lou Gehrig's disease, a degenerative neurological illness, his doctor gave him 2 years to live. Today, 37 years after that grim prognosis, Hawking not only lives, he is recently remarried and continues to set the pace in the field of global general relativity theory, the most advanced realm of modern physics. He has even become an actor by playing a role in person in an episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation. How does he do it? Confined to a wheelchair, unable to write. Hawking, for many years, spoke only in mumbles. Now, having lost his voice entirely, he communicates by painstakingly tapping out on a keypad messages that are then spoken by an electronic voice. Hawking has thus spent many years surrounded by attentive graduate students who hang on his every word and jot down on every thought, seize every nuance, a stimulating cycle of self-expression and feedback that may have kept him alive and lucid for the past 3.5 decades. Let us now examine the case of the physicist who could not understand math. The English inventor Michael Faraday was one of history's greatest scientific minds. His theory of electromagnetic fields and lines of force largely inspired Einstein's quest for relativity. Yet Faraday's methods have long puzzled the more straight-laced historians of science. Faraday was completely innocent of mathematics, marveled Isaac Asimov in his History of Physics. He developed his notion of lines of force in a remarkably unsophisticated way, picturing them almost like rubber bands. Scientists would probably never have known what to do with Faraday's electromagnetic fields had not James Clerk Maxwell later set them into math. Poor Faraday did his best to follow Maxwell's work, but he eventually grew so befuddled by the math that he wrote Maxwell, beseeching him to translate his hieroglyphics into the sort of common language that such as I could understand, quote unquote. Even less conventional, though, were Faraday's notebooks. He filled thousands of pages of notes and diaries with wild, unstructured, but often quite poetic, streams of thought. Today, every fall was foaming from the abundance of water, he wrote in his diary in 1841 after hiking near the waterfalls of Giesbach in Switzerland. The sun shone brightly, and rainbows seen from various points were very beautiful. One rainbow in particular caught Faraday's eye. It looked like a spirit strong in faith and steadfast in the midst of the storm, he wrote. And though it might fade and revive, still it held on, and the very drops, which in the whirlwind of their fury seemed as if they would carry all away, were made to revive it and give it greater beauty. As science writer Thomas West noted, it is perhaps more than coincidence that the phenomenon which so entranced Faraday, the persistence and strength of the rainbow's form in the midst of the waterfall's raging chaos, resembles so closely the mysterious manner by which lines of electromagnetic force preserved their shape in the formless ether. One frustrated scientist, attempting to reconstruct Faraday's scientific thought process from his writings, was appalled to find nearly every page filled with such seemingly aimless image streaming. The diaries have the irritating form of ideas jotted down, repeated, and forgotten, he wrote. Try as he might, this scientist searched in vain for anything that smacked of sustained reasoning. Instead, he encountered a morass of articulated and unarticulated principles, concepts, observations, and physical facts. At length, this hapless scholar was forced to conclude that the very lack of pattern was itself the evidence of how Faraday thought. Faraday suspended the need to understand, he concluded, and simply acknowledged the thoughts which came into his head. The coherence of ideas was not imposed by any prior framework, but was allowed to emerge from the chaos Faraday of thoughts. He was using a technique I call the portable memory bank. It's quite simple. You buy a small notebook and carry it around with you wherever you go, just as young Einstein and Faraday did. Write down in that notebook any stray thoughts that come into your head, whether or not they seem worth recording at the time. I need to share with you on several levels about the portable memory bank. It is an extremely important technique. Indeed, its practice by itself will take you halfway to genius. Let's begin back with the fact that you get more of what you reinforce. As we noted before, is one of the great basic laws of nature, like gravity is a law of nature. You get more of what you reinforce. In psychology, that's called the law of effect. If you reinforce your own subtler awarenesses, you will get more and more of those subtler awarenesses, and you reinforce the trait of being aware. It's that simple. To be more aware, respond to your own awarenesses. Responding to your own awarenesses, you reinforce that awareness, and you reinforce in yourself the trait of being aware. And the subtler the awareness that you can pick up on, the better for your brain. Respond in some way to your own subtler awarenesses, and you reinforce thereby into better contact with your consciousness those further reaches of your brain and mind which handle those subtleties, enriching all of your experience. How can you pick up on and reinforce your own subtler awarenesses? Image streaming is, of course, presently the most powerful and most direct way I know of for picking up on and reinforcing subtler awarenesses. But this side of image streaming, there are also some other very simple, specific things you can do, and foremost among them is keeping a portable memory bank. By this one thing, keeping and using a simple portable memory bank will build you very close to genius, almost without effort. Keep a pen and a simple notepad or set of index cards in your pocket, or else a pocket tape recorder. That becomes a portable memory bank if you use it in the way I'm about to describe. How often have you had an idea but didn't tell anyone about it or even write it down, and now it's forgotten? How often has that happened to you? 1,000,001 times, right? Did you know that each time you let an idea of yours slip by without responding to it in some way, you're reinforcing the behavior of being uncreative? But each time you do tell an idea to someone else, or write it down in your handy-dandy convenient portable memory bank, you reinforce in yourself the trait of being creative. Likewise, anything subtle that you happen to notice, the way someone came into the room, say, or the play of shadows on the wall, or the way the change in one word transformed the meaning of a whole sentence, anything that for you is subtle, but you happen to notice it. Each time you don't respond to your own subtler awarenesses, you reinforce the trait of being unperceptive. Each time you do point out a subtlety to someone or to record its observation in your portable memory bank, you make yourself more and more perceptive. As simply as that, I strongly recommend that you equip yourself with a portable memory bank and carry it with you. Carry it with you everywhere for 5 days even. I hope for more, but let's try for 5 days and use it. If you can record 30 to 50 ideas a day for 5 days, you will have so aroused your Einstein factor that it will be like for you that you are living in an entirely different universe. Recording your observations and perceptions is so powerful that even if you record only 30 observations on whatever, for only 3 days, even that mere 3 days will be enough to transform the world you're living in. So use that portable memory bank, or notepad, or index cards, or pocket tape recorder. 30 to 50 or so ideas a day for 5 days, or 30 subtle perceptions and observations each day for even merely 3 days, and you're halfway to full genius with your own Einstein factor well engaged. What if you forget to take your portable memory bank with you? Here's how not to forget. Put out a $5 bounty, a reward for anyone who catches you without your portable memory bank. You will remember. It does not take long practicing this technique before you notice a sharp increase in the number and quality of creative thoughts and interesting perceptions that pop into your head. In fact, compulsive scribbling is a crude form of image streaming. Like image streaming, it creates a feedback loop between your mind, which generates ideas, and your self-awareness, symbolized by the writing in your notebook. Which brings us to the drashta effect. The Hindus have a special word for self-awareness. They call it drashta, sometimes translated as the looker or witness. Drashta is purely objective. Drashta looks dispassionately on the world and even allows us to separate from our bodies and look back at ourselves. We can think of the notebook used for our portable memory bank as a method for reinforcing our drashta perspective. It allows us to scrutinize our own stream of subtle perceptions as if we were an outside observer. In image streaming, the tape recorder represents drashta, completing a feedback loop between our inner perceptions and our objective witness. But image streaming is far more direct and powerful than the portable memory bank. When we write in a notebook, we describe our thoughts only after the fact, when the flow of description can no longer feedback and influence our mental imagery. Moreover, journal writing neglects the faculties of speech and hearing, which are also so crucial to image streaming. Both techniques, though, both portable memory bank and image streaming, tend to bridge certain poles and stimulate certain brain faculties that are neglected by the other. They are most effective when they are used in tandem, especially when both are focused upon the same specific observations. An external focus, whether a person, an audience, a notebook, or a tape recorder, completes the loop, drawing subtle perceptions from a person that would not emerge on their own. I think maybe the insight that's most exciting to me currently that's come from the portable memory bank is this feed the loop model of human development, and it's becoming one of the main cores of this general theory and model of human development, creativity, and genius. Just fiddling in my portable memory bank, I began to see that maybe 9/10 or more of the actual feedback that is shaping our ongoing behavior and development and learning and growth and everything is coming not from the environment, but from our own output. This new feed-the-loop model has so many different applications and so many different implications that it looks like we're going to be busy for quite a while still working that out. But this started with a simple doodle in my portable memory bank. One of the applications of this feed-the-loop model has shown us very clearly and dramatically how to greatly enhance the child in the womb before he's even born, how to let more of that child emerge than could otherwise be possible. It's astonishing to know that over half the brain cells that you or I or anyone had at 7th month in the womb, over half of those brain cells have died by the time we're born, and they died of lack of use. Part of the answer has been in the recent upwelling of literature and suggested techniques for stimulating the baby in the womb, but stimulus is not the answer. It's a partial answer along the way, but something else is much more significant in terms of keeping those brain cells alive and letting the child be born more intact, more complete than would otherwise be possible. And this feed-the-loop model shows us exactly what. What the child needs is feedback, not just stimulus, but feedback. And how that works, let's say the child taps on the left side twice, well, you tap back on the left side twice. He taps on the right side however many times, you tap back some multiple, say 3 times as many times as he tapped on that side. If he taps towards the top, you put on the headphones and play music, or you talk to him or whatever. And as long as it's a consistent response, if you respond consistently to the child in the womb, then A child will feel that his actions are having some influence on his environment, and he's affecting some control on his surroundings, and he'll grow brain circuitry accordingly. And this, I believe, more than anything else, will keep a lot of those brain cells alive and engaged and let the child be born complete, let him be born whole and in greater reach of his potential. On one side, you just do the same number of taps. On the opposite side, you maybe do 3 times as many, but consistently 3 times as many. If you kick 7 times, you give him 21 taps. Twice, you give him 6 taps, and so on that side. And as long as you can make the response consistent, you're going to be doing something to keep more of that child alive and intact. And in fact, you can probably think up a number of different ways to respond to the child, maybe with music on one side and speech on another. But as long as you make your responses consistent, then the fetus will feel that he's making things happen and develop brain circuitry to guide that process. When the child is born, there are a lot of things also that can be done, and how my Feed the Loop model has instructed me on one issue in particular, I think, is a good example. In my original book on how to increase your intelligence, I was so pleased with having come up with one of these very simple ways of stimulating the visual development of the child by stringing up multicolored Christmas tree lights near the crib and for a few minutes at a time, several times a day, letting the newborn have the experience of those changes in light value, light and dark and color. And it is true that children who've had that process, had the benefit of that experience, are a lot more sharp and perceptive, visually speaking. Yet, if I were to do this again today, I would do something very different. What I would do today, and this reflects the Feed the Loop model, is to put pressure pad controls in the bedding, in the crib. And as the child moves around, those pressure pad controls turn on and off the different colored lights. And so the child is making things happen. And I believe this would be enormously more productive of visual development than even the Christmas. Unfortunately, feedback loops do not always promote brain development, as we saw with the example with a portable memory bank. Bad feedback will stunt the brain as powerfully as good feedback helps it. Ingenious expression is all too often punished in our society with mockery, envy, and adult disapproval. I once received some exceedingly bad feedback from my sixth grade history teacher back in 1949 in Harrisonburg, Virginia. I had remarked in class that it seemed unfair for some people to hoard all the wealth while others starved. Wouldn't it be better, I suggested, if wealth were divided more evenly? A more able teacher might have used my provocative question as a springboard to launch into basic lessons on economics. But, no doubt partly because the McCarthy era was just then dawning, this teacher reacted with fear and suspicion. "That would be communism," he shouted accusingly. "You wouldn't want that, would you?" "No." At the age of 11, I hardly knew what I wanted, but I was perceptive enough to know when I was being bullied. At my first opportunity, I repaired to the school library. Nothing there, I went to the town library, where I seized a copy of Karl Marx's Das Kapital from the shelf and plunged defiantly into its dense and inscrutable pages. Thanks mainly to Marx's soporific style, I avoided early conversion to the proletarian cause. In fact, by the time I received my Bachelor of Arts degree in economics, I had concluded that the free market ideals of Adam Smith and Henry Hazlitt, with some modifications, offer the fairest shake for all. Despite the happy ending, the bad feedback that that teacher provided could have done serious damage to my budding intellect, such as it is. A more sensitive, or perhaps less rebellious, child might have been intimidated for life from asking penetrating questions. For reasons I'll discuss in a few moments, bad feedback is one of the principal blocks to intelligence. Image streaming does offer the most effective way I know to correct and counteract its effects. We will continue in the next session.
When you tap into the power of image streaming, One of the benefits you'll acquire is that this amazing process will allow you to change your perspective on things. You'll increase your awareness and develop a new understanding that will give you some startling insights for accessing your Einstein factor. You'll also be taught an exercise called Instant Replay that will help you review and draw extra content from classes, lectures, conversations, or any type of experience. Wynn will share with you his own personal experience in this area and how he overcame negativity in his own life to become a genius. And now, here's Wynn.
Any good look at the history of science and technology suggests that what we need in our civilization, perhaps more than anything else, is a greater readiness to listen to what's coming from the peanut gallery. Let me share with you the peanut gallery principle. Experts, quote-unquote, have become the reigning priests of our day. Non-experts are sharply discouraged from expressing opinions. Yet many of the great discoveries in every field have been made by amateurs. Consider Einstein, the humble patent examiner, who presumed to contradict full physics professors. Or Heinrich Schliemann, the import-export entrepreneur, a salesman, so to speak, who unearthed the lost city of Troy after the experts had declared it to be a fable. It is unlikely that any learned scientist in 1831 would have attempted Michael Faraday's famous experiment of that year. Only the wildest hunch moved Faraday to test what would happen if he spun a copper disc between the two poles of a horseshoe magnet. Faraday himself was shocked to find that this device actually generated electricity. This discovery was an audacious mental creation, Einstein later remarked, which we owe chiefly to the fact that Faraday never went to school and therefore preserved the rare gift of thinking freely. Most of us, at one time or another, have felt a strong suspicion the experts were wrong about some fundamental claim in medicine, politics, economics, or a host of other subjects. We have a healthy, natural drive to jeer from the peanut gallery. Indeed, our American Republic is based upon this peanut gallery principle. Our Constitution presumes that ordinary citizens can best judge the common good, while such experts as judges, generals, and career politicians must be kept in check through a sharp separation of powers and through a free and vigilant press. Yet much of our training, whether in childhood, in college, or on the job, is designed to beat the peanut gallery principle out of us. We are taught to distrust our own opinions and lean on the opinions of experts. It is no accident that the greatest geniuses share a profound irreverence towards conventional opinion. The courage to be different is a cornerstone of high intellect. That is the real moral behind the fable of the emperor's new clothes. The emperor's subjects were told that they were fools if they could not see the emperor's invisible robe. By pretending to be wise, the townspeople showed themselves to be the biggest fools of all. The only true wise head among them belonged to that naive little boy who trusted his own perceptions and dared to proclaim that the emperor was naked. Here is another example of the same peanut gallery issue, the parable of the stuck truck. A truck once became jammed under an overpass because it was way too high for the clearance. Police and road crews came and tried to pry it out, but nothing seemed to work. Everyone had a different idea of how to free the truck. At first, they tried to empty some of the load, but that only made the truck lighter, causing it to rise and jam even more tightly against the overpass. They applied crowbars and wedges. They revved the engine. In short, they applied all the typical methods people use for unsticking cars, trucks, and other mechanical devices, but everything they tried only made matters worse. Then, a six-year-old boy came along. He glanced at the truck's axles and noted their height above the pavement. Then he offered the solution. Let some of the air out of the truck's tires. Problem solved. The police and road crews couldn't free the truck because they knew too much. Everything they knew about freeing jammed vehicles and machine parts somehow involved prying or yanking things loose through physical force. Likewise, most of our problems are only exacerbated by the things we know. Only when we shift our attention away from what we think we know to what we are actually perceiving are most problems resolved. This might sound easy, but in fact it's remarkably hard. Most people, when they begin image streaming, have great trouble confining their descriptions to their here-and-now sensory impressions. Their tendency is to gloss over their raw perceptions and talk abstractly about the images they see. They describe what they know about the images, not what they are actually perceiving. We will show how image streaming is used to answer questions and solve problems, but invariably the most effective image streamings arise when people focus on detailed sensory description of what they're actually perceiving, rather than talking abstractly about it.
Here is another example of our knowledge and expectations getting in the way. I call this example strangled eggs, please.
Once I conducted a rather silly experiment that nonetheless yielded much food for thought. It all started one day when I was ordering breakfast in a restaurant. I told the waitress that I wanted strangled eggs. Without batting an eyelash, the waitress brought me scrambled eggs, never noticing that I had asked for something slightly more exotic. Intrigued, I repeated this test on 70 different occasions over the next 6 years. Specifically, on those occasions when the restaurant was quiet and the server spoke good English. On 62 of those occasions, the waiter or waitress failed to notice that I had said strangled, despite the fact that I spoke in a strong, clear voice. A friend of mine who worked in a high-security area of the Pentagon tried a similar experiment. To pass through the security checkpoint, he needed an authorized badge with his name and picture on it. One day, he simply folded up a $5 bill so that only the picture of Abraham Lincoln appeared on it. No, he did not look like Abraham Lincoln. He then pasted Lincoln's portrait on the badge over his own picture. Although my friend wore this badge every day for the next year, not one guard out of the ever-changing sets of guards on duty ever did notice it. These crude experiments reflect a principle that has since been proved many times in more sophisticated studies. By and large, people see and hear exactly what they expect to see and hear, even if it differs from their actual perception. Psychologists call this set thinking, because the mind perceives what it is set to perceive. To some extent, set thinking is a necessary shortcut. We don't have time, for example, to pay attention to every syllable of every word we hear. It is convenient and sensible for a busy waitress to assume that her customers will ask for eggs only in certain set ways. Yet set thinking also gives rise to bigotry. It enables some people to assume that all blacks are dangerous or that all whites are racist, that all men are brutal or all women hysterical, that all Democrats are unprincipled libertines and all Republicans narrow-minded dolts. Set thinking also clouds the perceptions of scientists and statisticians who often see only what they expect to see in a given set of data. Image streaming seeks to wean the mind from its dependence on set thinking. The more we engage in image streaming, the more we reinforce behavior of relying upon our actual perceptions rather than on our prejudice. We learn to be what I call original observers. Original observers, people who perceive. Can you and should you be an original observer? To be an original observer is not far from being a genius. If we encourage children, and adults too for that matter, to ask questions and seek answers freely, their natural genius would astonish us. Indeed, all children start out as original observers up to the age of 4, when they start learning to use their minds and set their minds at a lower level of curiosity. This phenomenon partially accounts for the notorious instability of IQ scores in children below the age of 4 or 5. At that age, IQ tests are considered unreliable because a child of such tender years may test at a substandard level of 70 one week and come back the next week with a genius score in excess of 130. Educators prefer to wait until the child has ossified at a particular level before they begin testing. Unfortunately, most children have already learned by that time that it is bad to be an original observer, and their IQ scores reflect this idea. Such bad feedback will be with us for a long time, maybe forever. If we can't abolish it, though, how can we circumvent it?
on an individual level, some people manage to turn lemons into lemonade. They use bad feedback as a spur to become even better original observers. When my sixth grade history teacher scolded me for my question, he was unconsciously trying to train me in set thinking. He implied that questions about social justice were all lumped in a set or category called communist and should therefore not be raised. Because I was stubborn, I resisted this training and resolved to seek my own answers. As it turned out, my childish concern about inequality ultimately shaped my career. It drove me to study economics and to develop a profound appreciation for the liberties assured by a truly free market, something America has yet to institute. It later drove me to realize that self-improvement through education and accelerative learning was the truest path to dignity and equal opportunity for all. That same childish concern prompted me to complete a PhD in education, to write my dissertation on the subject of enhancing human intelligence, and finally to spend 25 years developing the technique of image streaming. In the end, I have to thank that miserable sixth grade teacher for making me angry enough to go out and seek my own answers. However, most people are not so fortunate as I. The bad feedback they receive may be far worse, or they may have been less well equipped to fight back. Indeed, the bad feedback they experience may have occurred so long ago, or may have been so unspeakably unpleasant, that they no longer even remember when or how they ceased to be original observers. Is there a way to turn lemons into lemonade, even years after the fact? Is there a way to go back and fix things after they've gone wrong? Indeed, there is. My study of the work of Swiss biologist Jean Piaget led me unexpectedly to the key. Piaget's schema of mental development, especially the mental development of a child, provides a roadmap whereby we can apply image streaming to repair past damage with almost surgical accuracy. What was Piaget's schema? Piaget studied his own children to determine a child's normal path of mental development. He noted that children's powers of thought and perception advance through distinct stages, the sensory-motor stage from birth to 18 months, the pre-operational stage up to 7 years old, and then the concrete operational stage, age 7 to 11, and the stage of formal operations, 11 to 15. But, of course, the actual ages vary from child to child. Children advance through these stages by engaging in prolonged feedback loops with the world around them, learning by trial and error. In the early pre-operational stage, for example, at around age 3 or 4 years, Piaget discovers that if you pour water from a short, thick glass into a tall, thin glass, the child will believe that there is more water in the tall glass because the water level is higher. The child will even be afraid that if you pour the water back into the squat container, it will overflow. He has not yet learned the principle of conservation. But after a certain number of years experimenting with liquids, the feedback loop will teach him first the important principle of the conservation of quantity, and after that, the principle of conservation. Problems do arise, however, according to Piaget, when a child skips over stages in the normal development, adopting concepts abstractly instead of grasping them intuitively. If, for example, adults in schools come along and teach the child that the amount of the water in the glass remains constant regardless of the container's shape, the child will have a less firm grasp of this concept than if he learned it through experience. He will have skipped an important step in development, and all subsequent stages will therefore rest upon a shakier foundation. That child's perception of himself, of others, and of the world and universe around him are from that point on damaged and weakened. His development in later years might be handicapped or distorted. Obviously, it is impossible, and even physically dangerous, for a child to have to learn everything by trial and error. Our ability to learn from others' experience is one of the things that makes us human. But such learning must allow the child to rediscover principles through a creative process similar to that of the principle's original discoverer. For example, Max Wertheimer, the founder of Gestalt Psychology, pointed out that when children grasp the underlying reason why the area of a parallelogram equals its base times its height, they not only remember the formula better than children who learn it by rote, but they easily go on to figure out on their own how to calculate the areas of many other geometric shapes. For this reason, Piaget has been greatly alarmed by the way his theories have been used to justify supercharged learning programs that bombard children with information out of sequence instead of allowing them to learn concepts from experience in their natural order. 30-some years ago in my doctoral dissertation, I speculated that people might be able to go back and repair such weak points in their own learning sequence through hypnotic regression. A trained hypnotist could regress a person back to a critical moment in his intellectual development and provide some enriching experience to build the key concept that had been taught out of sequence, and to build it in a sensory experience kind of way. Because such hypnosis would be difficult and expensive, I realized that it would benefit only a favored few, so I dropped the subject for about 18 years. Then in March of 1990 came an unexpected breakthrough. While working with a group of image streamers, I tried an experiment. First, I gave them a one-minute summation of Piaget's cognitive schema. I then asked participants to let your image streaming mind go back to some key point in your intellectual development, whether in childhood or even in early infancy. Your image streaming mind knows what that key point is, even if we don't. The imagers were then asked to describe to their partners whatever arose in their minds, even if it didn't seem to fit with Piaget's schema or anything else. Finally, working from whatever images did appear, they were to relax and let that experience move forward into a free-flowing fantasy in which they were to imagine being enriched by whatever experience or reinforcement was needed. Without exception, every participant was able to home in on precisely some key development episode and to enrich it in his imagination. He subsequently moved on to other episodes in his life and repeated the same process until finally arriving at the present. Future research needs to be done to reveal the extent to which such restorative work actually affects or builds intelligence, but the uplifting effect upon people using this technique at my seminars has been unmistakable. It is striking how easily and quickly they recall crucial episodes in their development, many of which they had long forgotten. This hypermnesia, or enhanced recall, is usually achieved only through profound and very expensive hypnotherapy, but image streaming provides it free of charge without the need for hypnosis. Here's one word of caution. Memory remains one of the most elusive of all mental phenomena. Psychologist Elizabeth Loftus, for example, has shown experimentally that at least 25% of the population can easily be made to remember experiences that never occurred. Quite by accident, Loftus discovered that she herself was among that 25%. When she was 44 years old, an uncle told Loftus that it was she who had discovered her mother's body after her mother drowned in a swimming pool 30 years before. Soon after, the memories began to drift back, said Loftus, quoted in Psychology Today. My mother, dressed in her nightgown, was floating face down. I started screaming. I remembered the police cars, their lights flashing. For 3 days, my memory expanded and swelled. Then Loftus's brother told her that her uncle had been mistaken. It turned out that her Aunt Pearl, not Loftus, had found the body. In fact, Loftus had never seen it. I was left with a sense of wonder at the inherent credulity of even my skeptical mind, Loftus said. Let me describe in a moment some exercises that will help you remember and enrich peak learning experiences. But I must caution you that it is impossible to say whether the memories that arise are real, partially real, or entirely symbolic and metaphorical. What is important is that the memory means something to you and that your unconscious has presented it in a useful and workable format. First of all, just let me underscore the fact that image streaming is not hypnotic. Something very different. Although a trained hypnotist, I long ago rejected hypnotism as an aid in learning and development, not only because it is costly, but because it places too much power in the hypnotist's hands and is far too easy to abuse. Indeed, I specifically developed image streaming as a non-hypnotic alternative. The imager is fully conscious at all times, fully in control, and no more susceptible to suggestion than a person who is daydreaming while walking down the street. Nevertheless, when we drop the guards of our memories, the effects can be unpredictable. For this reason, I do not recommend unsupervised image streaming to people who are delusional or severely disturbed, even though, under appropriate supervision, such image streaming might be an effective treatment for some such individuals. If a truly painful memory does emerge while you're image streaming, I recommend that you discuss it with a licensed therapist. Even then, you must choose your therapist wisely. In the last few years, millions of people have, with the help of regressive hypnosis, succeeded in remembering traumatic experiences that include not only childhood abuse, but also alien abduction and past reincarnation. I would not presume to say which or how many of these experiences really happened, but Loftus's studies indicate that at least 25% may be false memories. In short, if you must seek therapy, find a practitioner with a responsible attitude towards the use and limitations of recovered memory. A therapist who encourages you to trust blindly in the veracity of such memories is not doing you a service. It is important to keep in mind that when using the procedure of cognitive structural enhancement that we're about to describe, we are seeking not actual memories, but rather a key or guide to your past development, however metaphorical, symbolic, or real it may be. Such insights are just as often accompanied by real and recognizable memories as not. So here is cognitive structural enhancement, a form of amplifying feedback. Our goal is to retrieve and enrich our memories of what Abraham Maslow called peak learning procedure I use is called cognitive structural enhancement, or CSE. Please do not attempt it until you have mastered the basics of image streaming through at least several hours of practice. Here are the instructions for cognitive structural enhancement. And as always, refer to your workbook for further detail on any of these exercises. Find a comfortable and uninterrupted space, and let's begin. 1. Let your image streaming faculties take you back to some key point early in your intellectual development. 2. Describe to your partner or to a tape recorder whatever comes up in your vision, whether it fits or fits any expectation or not. Just let the images unfold freely. 3. Let your image streaming faculties imagine for you the most effective and appropriate experience that would have enriched your understanding at that key point. Describe your way through that experience out loud to your tape recorder or to a listener. 4. Let your image streaming faculties move you forward in time from that early childhood experience to other key points of development that follow directly from it. 5. Enrich each of these memories in turn by describing them at length in concrete sensory detail. Six. Continue the procedure until you have worked your way up to the present time. Seven. Invest at least a few minutes in detailing to a partner or to a tape recorder the specific improvements that you feel this series of enrichment experiences has made in your present-day understanding and perception. At this point, you may want to turn this tape off for maybe 3 minutes and give yourself some time to contemplate this exercise. Let's face it, image streaming is just simply darn useful in a lot of different ways. It's not only good for you like some medicine might be good for you. It's not only entertaining by the content of the images that you get, but you can use it for a lot of different things. You can use it to solve problems. You can use it to rebuild even the very foundations of your understanding, as we were just exploring. Image streaming can help you review and draw extra content from classes, lectures, conversations, or almost any other type of experience, whether it took place years ago or in the last 5 minutes. The technique I use for this purpose is called instant replay, after the practice of sportscasters in reviewing TV footage of athletic feats. Instant replay was first developed and brought to my attention by the late Dr. Raymond H. Cameron, Ph.D. I have adapted and applied Dr. Cameron's technique in accordance with the theory and practice of image streaming. In instant replay, unlike in cognitive structural enhancement, you select the experience to be reviewed. Perhaps you simply want to gain insight into a conversation you had with another person. Perhaps you attended a class or a workshop recently and suspect that it contained more value than you'd consciously received. Perhaps you had an all-too-fleeting brush with a great teacher, for example, a famous person in your field, and you want to savor and expand on that moment. Or perhaps you were an athlete and wish to review your last game or meet. Instant replay can help you in these and many other situations. You can extract the content you need from an experience as conveniently as if you possessed a videotape of the event, available for review at your pleasure. As you grow adept at instant replay, you will see almost every replayed event, however simple or ordinary, grow rich with startling and unsuspected meaning. When you replay a lecture or workshop, for example, you will draw out content of which even the teacher or lecturer was not aware. Instant replay simulates the manner in which a truly comprehensive genius perceives the world, enfolding the most ordinary situations with layers of meaning, metaphor, and profundity. Replaying your experiences through the image stream is like beholding a gorgeous sunset in full color after spending your life colorblind. As with cognitive structural enhancement, not all the experiences you select for instant replay necessarily would be pleasant ones. This technique offers the chance to make lemonade from lemons, turning even the most embarrassing, discouraging, or enraging episodes into object lessons to be savored, digested, and transformed in your imagination to ensure that you've paid all that tuition for that unhappy experience. You might as well get your money's worth of learning from that experience. Most events are happy, and we also happily can learn from them. In preparing for instant replay, you want to perform your instant replay as soon as possible after the event or situation that you've selected. Of course, as soon as possible can mean several years after the fact if you've selected a long-ago event. Use a tape recorder or live partner. If you use a partner, it is better, but not essential, to recruit someone who experienced the same event. When you practice instant replay for the first time, it is best to select peak learning experiences with obvious special meaning to you. Your success in replaying such experiences will reinforce your instant replay responses and make it easier for you to draw meaning later from more ordinary events whose lessons have eluded your conscious notice. Find a comfortable and uninterrupted space, and let's begin. Here's the instant replay procedure. Think of yourself as an astronaut who has just returned from some exotic mission. You must now engage in a thorough debriefing, describing every detail of your journey to scientists for study back in mission control. Step 1. Close your eyes and practice velvety smooth breathing. Let your breath stroke your body like a long, smooth strip of velvet. Step 2. Bring forth a concrete memory of the event that you have selected. By concrete, I mean with sensory detail. What was the setting it occurred in, or the feeling, or what was right in front of you? Something sensory in that event. Step 3. Describe the event sequentially to your partner or tape recorder as it really happened in accordance with the normal rules of image streaming. That is, describe it in the present tense and in rich sensory detail. Your partner should keep his coaching to an absolute minimum to interfere as little as possible with the flow of your own description. Step 4. For the first 4 or 5 minutes, confine your description to sensory impressions of the setting, the teacher or other key person, the other participants, the action, your feelings, and even body awareness. Only sensory detail. As in normal image streaming, do not hesitate to fudge and make things up if it'll help keep the stream going. When you have established the sensory setting very clearly, begin to open yourself to more abstract insights. Feel free to make comments and judgments about the action before you. Don't worry if these judgments seem wise or correct. If they have popped into your mind at this point, they are important, so express them. Six, soon the images may change or twist in some unexpected, even bizarre way. They may be replaced with entirely new images that at first seem unrelated. These new or changed images are a reflexive response from the broader, unconscious regions of your mind. They are a symbolic representation of some vital insight about the replayed scene. Contained within these images is a message. A message about your selected experience. If you persist in your image streaming, this message will burst upon you in the sort of sudden, all-encompassing insight that Abraham Maslow called an aha moment. Finally, step 7, continue describing the new image for 10 or so minutes or until you achieve a clear aha experience. At this point, you may want to turn this tape off for maybe 3 minutes to give yourself some time to contemplate this exercise. In pursuing this, it's important to know that the best ideas usually come last. In the creativity technique known as brainstorming, people are urged to throw out ideas freely without worrying about whether the ideas are good. Generally, the best ideas come near the end of brainstorming sessions, after participants have loosened up and allowed their subtler perceptions to come into play. In like manner, instant replay improves as the session progresses. The last ideas you discover tend to be the most valuable. Here's a suggested schedule for you. If you practice instant replay for 15 to 30 minutes per day on whatever in your life can be reviewed, it will, within 10 to 21 days, exert a profound impact on your life and on your powers of perception. For thousands of years, men and women have yearned for a second chance to right past mistakes and to draw more value from those rare peak moments that invariably arise so seldom and pass too quickly. Instant replay offers something very close to that opportunity. As we have seen, human development arises from a feedback loop, a never-ending progression of expression and response, of trial and error. Image streaming offers you the opportunity to run that feedback loop again and again, and I think you'll find benefits you to a great degree.